आप वहां कर देंगे कि हो गया अभी
आप कर बाद में
ये ऑन करना होगा
Okay, good evening everybody. So now we will have the so-called asset colloquium, Advances in Science Leading to Technology. This is a long history of this colloquium in TIFR, and the basic purpose of this colloquium has been where a very diverse audience is expected to attend such colloquia, and we try to see how specific advances in technology have led to the development of fundamental science. And in this context, I think probably it is very apt that today's speaker is Shivraj Shivaramakrishnan. And I'll tell you a little bit about him. We will not have a very detailed introduction. We'll get started. And I'm hoping that more people will trickle in as we go on. So Shiv started his life, if I may call it, as learning mechanical engineering at the University of Pune. From here, he moved to the US to do a master's degree again in mechanical engineering. And so it's probably very apt that an engineer by his initial training at least kind of is now working in biology and is going to talk about the basic science, very beautiful science that he is doing, bringing in his background to this field. So after that, Shiv did a PhD at Northwestern University where he was in biomedical engineering, but in that course he got introduced to the cytoskeleton, and his initial work during the PhD days was really on trying to understand the mechanical properties of the cytoskeleton, which of course I guess at some point brought in the motors. And then he moved on to work for a postdoc with Jim Spudick at Stanford, where he really kind of, I think, he came to the motor field, and we are glad for that because that's why you are here with us today. And he started his work on the myosin motors, and which he has now advanced in a different way at his present position as associate professor at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. What is really nice about the work that Shiv has been doing, and you will, I need not tell you this, you will see that, is that how he is neither at the extreme of physics, which is kind of abstracted from biology, nor is he at the end of biology where you don't really talk about mechanical, physical phenomena, but he is integrating these two very nicely, and therefore it is only appropriate that he should call his lab the Protein Acrobatics Lab, where he is trying to understand by, you know, engineering proteins, by trying to understand the mechanical properties of the proteins, how they really work. And he gave us a beautiful example of that when a few days ago at the other meeting, where he showed us how specific myosin motors, which are, you know, supposed to go towards the cortex of the cell, are supposed to come in, how they behave differently on branched actin filaments, which he has developed as a very nice system. So with those few words, Shiv, a very warm welcome to you, and so over to you now.
Thank you. Can you hear me in the back? Okay. As the title of my talk implies, I will not be talking about molecular motors, but it does pertain to the spirit of the ASET colloquium, as you will see. And for those of you who are not familiar with biology or aren't thinking about biological systems deeply, I would posit that hopefully what you'll take away from this talk is bringing more quantitative ways of thinking about biological problems, especially cell signaling, that, as you will see, the advances that we're making require more computational and modeling efforts, but now with more clarity as to what is happening on the biological front. And as the title of my talk implies, I'm going to talk about cell signaling. In part, the reason I decided to choose cell signaling is some of you here were also at the previous meeting, so I wanted to talk on a slightly different topic. But also, this is a large area of what my lab does in addition to working on molecular motors. And you know, it'll be good for you to also think about different aspects of our research. The one theme that's common between this and what we're talking about in the current meeting was highlighted by Krishanu's work, actually, here, which is the idea that molecular motors, when they function in concert, we're moving away from this thinking of molecular motors as rigid transporters that are moving things over long distances, and everything is either static, not moving, or moving at very high rates. And the molecular motors field and the transport field is much more interested in understanding how interactions that are transient and dynamic contribute to cellular processes. And so in that spirit, this should fit in terms of our thinking of how that same concept applies in cell signaling. I'll start by first acknowledging the people who do the work. This is my lab at the University of Minnesota. We have about four postdocs. Some of you might recognize Ashim. I gave a talk here 3 years ago, and Ashim was here, and we're very happy to have him, and he's doing really well. He works on molecular motors. I will not be highlighting his work. We have four postdocs, two graduate students, and junior scientists, and we're always on the lookout for people who are interested in bringing different ways of thinking into biology, especially trying to integrate technology, computation, and fundamental biological thinking. So what we like to work on in my lab, and in an umbrella sense, we like to call it the wisdom of crowds, which is more fancily called the intrinsic regulation of protein interaction networks. So what I mean by that is, let's say I illustrate that using a cell that we study, which is a cardiac myocyte. And there's a stimulus that the cell experiences from the outside. This stimulus could be a hormone, it could be an odorant, it could be anything that the cell wants to sense from the outside world. And an example here of the complexity of the problem is illustrated in this layout. So here I'm illustrating G protein coupled receptors, which are signal transducers. Their goal is to basically transfer information from the outside of the cell to the inside of the cell. But this is, of course, not restricted to GPCRs. Conceptually, it also applies to the receptor tyrosine kinase family of proteins, which are the other major wing of transducers into the cell. But the problem is that a single stimulus, typically in a given cell, will activate multiple receptors. This is illustrated, say, for example, for adrenaline, which will activate multiple GPCRs or multiple isoforms of the GPCR in the same cell, present in the same proximity of the cell. Each GPCR then goes on to activate multiple G proteins. And so as you go further into the cell, what you can hopefully appreciate from this hairball of a diagram is the progressive convolution of information. So if you think of it in mathematical terms or engineering terms, you have a clean signal coming from the outside, and the cell inherently convolves that signal as you go further in. The cell is actually very good at convolving signals, and it's the deconvolution, if you want to take away the big picture message of this talk, that biologists really struggle with. because it's the unlike, say, a traditional, say, a Fourier transform is something where you would just want to deconvolve the information. If you don't know the circuitry in between, so if you're an electrical engineer and you wanted to deconvolve information, the circuitry is hardwired, and you know how to deconvolve it based on how you could write the equations that led to the convolution in the first place. But in biology, I would posit the real challenge is with all these multiple interactions, unless biologists do precise experiments which allow us to understand how the system works, mathematicians are often at a loss, and physicists are often at a loss as to what sort of framework, mathematical framework, they should apply to then deconvolve this information. And I will present one example in detail with GPCRs that's actually very relevant to drug discovery today. And we have patents filed on this because we're excited about using this technology to build precise medicines. If you go further into the cell, you will find essentially kinases. And kinases are, I would say, the microprocessors of the cell, because what they're really good at doing is confusing biologists. But basically, their goal in life is to make the life of PhD students miserable, because depending upon what signals come in, something completely different comes out. And when you talk about a kinase, I can guarantee you any prominent kinase, this is showing PKC alpha, if you was to PubMed it, you will find 20,000 citations, and I can guarantee you that it phosphorylates pretty much everything known to man based on the citations if you take them at face value. So the difficulty for biologists is figuring out how different stimuli are actually integrated as a microprocessor would do, but not one-off. This is not one-off hardwiring, but it's really the interactions within the kinase that really lead to this convolution of information inside the network. And of course, we're talking about motors. The motors are the ultimate example of wisdom of crowds. And as we've heard from multiple talks, these molecules have evolved to function in teams. They seldom function at a single level. And they have evolved to work in groups and teams to give rise to higher order function. So I will apologize for not talking about motors, but hopefully keep you entertained with enough information about GPCRs and kinases for the purposes of today's talk. Okay, so now let's take a step back. So the contemporary view of cell signaling, if you were to pick up any journal from Cell Nature Science down to, say, JBC, you would find that, you know, this is how people think of cell signaling. It's essentially a mad chase where you would have, say, a GPCR on the membrane, and then, of course, in this case, it's a signal transducer. If you don't think of GPCRs, just think of it as progressive flow of information. A tags B, B then goes on to amplify the signal. The amplified signal then hits C, and then information flows. And as you go further into the signaling cascade, you start seeing nodes where basically information converges. You see hubs where information diverges. And that's what makes signaling so complex and essentially a problem that's been not so tractable from an engineer or a physicist standpoint. Part of the reason this is so complicated is it's not even enough to draw those diagrams the way we do. When we fundamentally look at the cytosol, as shown here from a diagram from David Goodsell, is chock full of proteins. And what biologists tend to gloss over is the fact that any question you ask has to be asked in the context of multiplicity. So here again, I'm showing you a signaling cascade, and you would kind of be baffled to say, well, this is the same sort of signaling cascade that I showed you a slide earlier, but here you have it. You have the molecule VEGF in pink out there. You have two receptors that oligomerize out here, bind together, and then you actually have some molecules that are actually hanging out here. So all of this is drawn to scale that communicate the signal through a series of phosphorylation events going through a nuclear pore complex activating transcriptional machinery. And when you look at this, which looks like, a sub-Z Monday on a crowded day, you wonder how the cell actually manages to function at all, because despite the idea that there are specific structural interactions, there is a lot of space in which the proteins essentially get to interact and function. And the bigger picture challenge for us as engineers or people bringing engineering thinking is, how do we reduce the level of complexity in the system to a point that we can actually ask meaningful questions and model them in meaningful ways? Okay, so I'm going to start without further ado with a story on GPCRs that will highlight also the technology aspect that my lab brings to sort of provide hopefully a little bit of clarity into this complex space. So the work specifically done here, most of it that I'm going to highlight, the later work, is the work of a really talented postdoc, Tejas, who did his PhD from INSTEM, the Institute in Bangalore, and has been with me for a little over 2 years. And it was nucleated before him by Rabia Malik, who was a former grad student of mine and also supported by a junior scientist in my lab, Matt Disty. So a quick introduction, because as Roop mentioned, this is a broad audience, and also for those of you who are still waiting for the caffeine kick to kick in, let's reintroduce GPCRs. So GPCRs are the signal transducers. They're proteins that are embedded in the membrane, and essentially what they do is a ligand binds to the GPCR. The GPCR undergoes a conformational change. The structure of the protein changes very subtly, and that allows the information to go from the outside of the cell to the inside of the cell. That leads to the coupling or activation of the G protein. We've heard a lot about RABs. Well, this is a different type of G protein. This is the big G protein, but essentially functions the same way. The GPCR acts as a GEF or a guanine nucleotide exchange factor on the G protein. And the G protein now couples and gets activated by the GPCR, and it exchanges GDP for GTP, and there's functional dissociation of the alpha and beta gamma subunits. And then there are these signal amplifiers which allow one unit of this to be converted into multiple units of that. Okay? So just a refresher on GPCRs. The problem in the context of drug discovery is that all of the signal detection that happens in terms of assays to detect what the signaling output of a GPCR is done here. Makes sense. If you want a high fidelity assay that tells you about how much signaling there is through a GPCR, you will look downstream where the signal is automatically amplified. But where the drug discovery is happening right now, if you've been paying attention to a lot of the GPCR structures that have been coming out in the last 4 or 5 years, every Nature cell issue, every Nature issue in particular, they tend to favor GPCRs, has a new structure of a new GPCR. They all kind of look a little similar, but and the devil is in the details, but we are learning a lot about the ligand binding pocket, which allows for specificity. Because as pointed out here, there are about 800 different types of GPCRs in your body. About a third of them are in your nose right now that allow you to smell. Many of them are in your eyes that allow you to see. And then, of course, depending upon other systems that are now functioning in your body, you basically have other receptors operating as well. So the challenge is that these are meant to decode very different signals, and part of the way you decode those signals is by having slight changes here in the extracellular vestibule that recognizes a different ligand. So coming back to the idea of developing specific therapies in GPCRs, we can use the structures and a lot of computational biology and medicinal chemistry and design exquisitely selective molecules that will target the GPCR. But then now when you put that ligand or the molecule onto the cell, you're detecting signals down here. And so you might say, well, that looks straightforward because the GPCR activates the G protein, so there's a one-to-one transfer of information. And as I mentioned before, that is not the way the system is set up to work. The same ligand will bind, in this particular case, again illustrating the same example, to multiple GPCRs. Each GPCR will activate more than one G protein, often simultaneously and in the same cell type. And each G protein exerts influence on multiple second messengers. So the difficulty is in trying to figure out what kind of ligand you want cannot necessarily be derived from information down here. And this even becomes more interesting in the context of the cell that I showed you that picture going back, because it's not wired like this, it's wired like this, where each receptor, by definition, has access to all these molecules in this Brownian water bath. Things are able to touch each other, things are able to interact, and they're interacting at very quick timescales because diffusion is much faster than the process of activation of any of this. So the GPCR, in fact, is interacting or colliding with lots of these molecules, and the question then becomes, in that context, how do you decipher how information goes from here to here? So to answer such a difficult problem, we have to pose a simple question. So the very simple first order question that we posed is, okay, this is a receptor, we know it can activate this G protein. What is the role that the non-cognate meaning a G protein that it either activates or it doesn't activate as well, does not activate as well, play in this equation? Okay, so in order to answer that question, as you can imagine, we need to be able to do this experiment inside the cell where there's a lot happening at any given point in time. We also want to do it in a way that's controlled. So we want to be able to perturb the system and see the response that comes out of the system. So here's our perturbation experiment. So if you were to think of it in, I'm a trained fluid dynamist, so I can tell you that this is sort of a perturbation problem where if you're doing a simulation, you basically perturb the system by varying a parameter, and then you look at how the whole complex system responds, and then you decipher back from it what variables are involved underneath. So the way we perturb the system is we actually take the GPCR, and we tether it to the alpha subunit of AG protein, and we use a linker to tether it, and this is shown to scale so you can appreciate that I am not linking them and forcing an interaction. This GPCR is welcome to interact with this G protein. It is, of course, welcome to interact with everything else in the cell, and if it chooses not to do anything with this G protein, it doesn't have to. So it's a perturbation on top of what is happening inside the cell, and this perturbation is being used to infer something about the properties of the system as a whole. So what is this linking method? It comes from this playfully named technique that I developed in my postdoc, which I call playfully systematic protein affinity strength modulation, or SPASM. And the idea is that you take any two proteins or protein domains, and you link them with this ERK alpha helix, which is a single alpha helical domain that actually we identified in the molecular motor myosin 6, the same motor that I talked about in the previous meeting. And what this helical domain allows you to do is it allows you to separate these two proteins and really very carefully control the interaction between these two proteins inside a cell. And in addition to that, I'm also putting these beacons, a FRET donor and a FRET acceptor. And you know, without going into the details, these beacons allow us to actually not only allow us to monitor the state of this interaction. So these two beacons are close together. You have high FRET or fluorescence resonance energy transfer. So the degree of FRET that you get quantitatively reflects how much is in this state versus how much is in this state. So a little bit more information about this ERK alpha helix. So this ERK alpha helix.
Chief, do you have a question?
Yes. Yes.
But you still could be causing some chain. I don't know how this linker is going to behave upon stimulus and upon conformational change on GPCR.
Right.
Aren't you worried about bringing something, or have you tried to do some, take some measures to see whether you're inducing?
I'll actually show you the data. So I'm going to go into detailed data. So if I haven't answered your question in a few slides, I will check back with you. And then maybe if I have misunderstood your question. Okay, so what this single alpha helical linker is made of is an alternating sequences of E and R and E and K. And it is this precise alternating sequence of charges that allows you to stabilize a single alpha helix. So for people who are structural biologists, if I was to take an alpha helix from a folded protein and put it in water, it will unravel. And the reason it will unravel is because water is a polar solvent, and the backbone CONH bonds will be attacked by the dipole of water, and the protein will just disappear. In this case, what ends up happening is that these large side chains, glutamic acid, lysine, arginine, and aspartic acid, actually, first of all, shield the backbone from the solvent. And also, in addition, they undergo kiss-and-go interactions. So these are long-range electrostatic interactions. And of course, water is going to displace them as well. But the organization of these interactions ensures that at any given point, the structure is stable through interactions between the backbones. So for example, this glutamic acid is playing tag with this lysine, and then at some point, it will go ahead and play tag with that lysine. So the main idea here is that we now have a long single alpha helical linker. As I mentioned, we identified it initially in the motor protein myosin 6, but just by way of clarifying, these are frequently occurring structures in naturally occurring proteins, all the way from metallobacteria to Homo sapiens, and also they come in various different lengths. In all cases, pretty much, that we've seen, they occur in the middle of the proteins. In other words, it's forming some sort of spacer, if you will, between two protein domains. And that's what gave us the idea that we could use this to somehow modulate interactions between proteins. So if I was to put this linker between two proteins, this is sort of the conformational space that it will occupy. And what we've been able to show using a lot of careful biophysical and biochemical measurements is that the on rate of this interaction, which now, of course, reduces from a second order rate constant to a first order rate constant in a tethered interaction, only depends on the length of the helix. The off rate is interaction specific. So the way we understand that biophysically is the linker is long and elongated and fluctuating in a thermal bath. At some low probability stochastically, the linker unravels. We don't know exactly know why. There's probably weak spots in the linker. And then when it unravels, it probably undergoes a helix to coil transition. The proteins can now interact. And they stay interacting. And then at some point, stochastically, they'll come apart at the off rate of the protein interaction. And the linker will snap back open.
So you infer these on and off rates from all atom MD?
Not all atom MD. We can actually titrate. We published this, but I'll mention it. So we can take it and use FRET as a readout. And we can titrate dark protein. And from that, we can measure on and off rates. We can do them kinetically, or we can do them equilibrium. So we can measure all these parameters in experiment. And what got us excited about going into using this as a tool to understand cell signaling is this graph here, which is as you go from a 10 to a 20 to a 30 nanometer linker, you're going from, and just to be clear, the 30 nanometer linker is about 300 angstroms, so it's really long in terms of the length along the backbone. So I'm talking about the length along the backbone. For structural biologists, but even though it's 300 angstroms or 30 nanometers long, it's only about the size of a GFP. So it only adds about 30 kilodaltons of molecular weight. So it's not really you don't pay a penalty in terms of protein expression when you make this linker. So when you look at a 10 nanometer effective concentration of about 10 micromolar, when you go down to a 30 nanometer linker, you have an effective concentration of about 100 nanomolar. And that depends not on the dissociation constant, but mainly upon the length of the linker. There is, of course, some variation depending upon the dissociation constant, but it mainly depends on the effective concentration that the two proteins see each other is something that the linker essentially controls. Okay, so we have used this in multiple different contexts. I'll just mention some of these, so because I'm going to dive into a specific example very soon. But we published numerous papers using the system. We can engineer them between enzymes. So let's say you have an enzyme that is, say, inactive when it's open. You can actually open the molecule, and then depending upon the length of the linker, you can drive it from an inactive to an active state. An example of this is focal adhesion kinase, where we can control the activity of the kinase by modulating the intramolecular interaction. We also engineered cooperative binding, because you get long distances over which you can bid binding. You have one epitope, a second epitope, and you can actually engineer cooperativity and drive up the strength of the interaction. The case that I'm going to talk about, I'll provide one more example and then I'll dive into this. We've been quite effective at mapping the overall conformation of multi-domain proteins. Multi-domain proteins are sort of the dark matter of the protein world, where basically you have lots of regulatory domains that are stitched together, and people study and know the functions of individual domains, but when they all start working together, the madness that ensues is sort of unclear. So we've been able to just move this agnostically in between multiple domains, and we can ask very nice questions about the coarse conformation and what sort of interactions are important in the context of the whole molecule. So here what I'm going to talk about is how we actually engineer interactions between two proteins in live cells. So here's how the system works. I take the full length GPCR, I have a single plasmid construct, and then I put this module in at the tail of the GPCR. And then I can use varying length linkers, and I can make these cells where basically I have either a 10, a 20, or a 30 nanometer linker. And it's tethered now to the end terminus of the G-alpha subunit. The beta-gamma subunit is provided by the cell, and we verified that. And so what we can do is now all of this is in live cells, but basically, as we increase the length of the linker from 10 to 20 to 30, the FRET ratio now in live cells is a measure of the strength of the interaction. So as I mentioned, the effective concentration decreases as you make the linker longer, and so the FRET ratio drops. And now, importantly, I'm able to tune the amount of signaling that comes downstream. So this is an example of the kind of experiment that allows us to know that we're not completely messing up the system, and we do these sorts of controls for any sort of interaction that I'm presenting to you, but I'll move ahead and you can always ask specific questions later. Okay, so having built the system and extensively characterized the system, which I'm not going to, we can go back and ask that original question that I asked. What is the role of the non-cognate G protein in that whole mess where all sorts of interactions are possible? So now, given that the linker controls the effective concentration of the system, I can actually pairwise compare the amount of signaling that comes when I tether a cognate G protein, which is G alpha S, or a non-cognate G protein, G alpha Q. So in this case, what we find is if I take the beta 2 adrenergic receptor, which is cognate for S, and therefore produces cyclic AMP, If I take an untransfected cell in response to isoproteinurol, I will get some cyclic AMP. There are multiple receptors in the cell that respond to isoproteinurol. I take the beta 2 receptor and not, with nothing tethered at the end, of course, the presence of the receptor alone will drive more signaling. I put GS, which is the combination of the G alpha S and the beta gamma subunit provided by the cell. Of course, having more GS around that can interact with the receptor drives up the signaling. And here's the very paradoxical result. This G alpha Q subunit, which should not be activated by the beta 2 receptor, and even if activated, should not produce cyclic AMP, is tethered at the end of the receptor. It produces 1.5 times the amount of cyclic AMP that is produced when you put the cognate G protein. So this is something you would absolutely not expect. You have this in your linear thinking dimension as a cell biologist. Receptor activates GS, GS produces cyclic AMP. Everything else is dark matter that you blissfully ignore in your cell biology experiments. This is not unique to the beta 2 receptor. The D1 dopamine receptor also has a similar profile, and we see the same effect of GS, GQ enhancing substantially the signaling in the presence of dopamine. So I put this up just to highlight for students in the audience that oftentimes the most interesting results start when something absurd happens at the bench. And so please don't ignore that. We ignored it at our panel for some time because we said this is an artifact, let's sweep it under the rug, never talk about it again. But then we got curious, we said, you know, maybe there's something to it, let's just start dissecting this and see if there's something underneath here. So first thing we can do is we can actually ask, is this some sort of downstream effect, or is it actually the effect of having that G protein interacting with the receptor? So now I can do a controlled experiment where I can make the beta 2 receptor and I can increase the length of the linker. And as you make the linker longer and make so all of these measurements will be done with exactly the same level of expression of the protein. So everything else is being controlled for from an engineer's mind. And so the idea is that as I go from 10 to 20 to 30, the amount of signaling decreases. And the same happens with the beta 2 tethered to GQ. When I go from 10 to 20 to 30, the signaling also decreases. So it's something to do with this non-cognate G protein that's hanging around, interacting with the receptor that's actually producing more cyclic AMP. And to our satisfaction, when you go to 30 nanometers, these two signals are about the same, which means that when you get to a very weak interaction, the GPCR looks like the same from the perspective of this construct and this construct. So, of course, we know signaling pathways are convolved. We know that if for some reason it was able to activate the Q subunit, then it will come down like a Rube Goldberg machine, activate PKC, which will go on to phosphorylate adenylate cyclase, produce more cyclic AMP. Yes? Yeah, these are weak interactions. No one's actually made precise measurements, but generally by titrating these responses, we know that the affinities are on the order of 5 to 10 micromolar, and the linkers we're using engineer about that much interaction. GQ is weaker by about 2 to 3 fold compared to GS. This is empirical based on signaling and sort of pull down type of experiments. Precise experiments in this regime are difficult to do because these are very weak interactions.
And the follow up question, that is that when you look at, and of course you are ignoring the spatial context in real life.
Yes.
So what are the decision constants for these, and are these tethered and spatially localized? Is that something again you consider?
Yes. So the effective concentrations that people predict, these are apparent concentrations because the G protein is also in the membrane, the GPCR is also in the membrane, and both of them we have no reason to believe that they are in different microdomains. It's possible, but with the assumption that they're not in the same microdomains, it's about tens of micromolar concentration, and they are all mingling with each other. So the linker is in fact about the same as what you would expect in a cell, to the best of our engineering understanding. Yes? Yes.
Under natural physiological conditions, the cell type that you use, do they have equivalent, or is that?
Good question. So, in the context of the cell, GS is a little bit more expressed than GQ by about a factor of 2, and this is cell type dependent. So, as you will see, is a good question because as we go further, this will explain how to think about why GPCRs don't really function the same way. in different contexts. And
so again, if you put all these three together, then you're actually kind of suggesting that the JS interaction will become much more accurate.
Yes. I buy that, but keep in mind that even we're not talking about orders of magnitudes as physicists. We're talking about only a factor of two lower for GQ. But keep in mind that with GQ around, you're getting about 1.5 times the amount of signal than GS. So that's actually quite paradoxical still. So it's still suggesting to an interesting phenomena, but the physiological relevance we'll get to in a minute. Yeah. Good question. So I think that the intramolecular interactions dominate. You can, of course, we're not constraining it, so it could obviously talk to somebody else in the neighborhood. But in terms of like what you would expect for diffusion constants, these are sparse proteins. The intramolecular interactant, the effective concentration you drive in the intramolecular interaction dominates over the intermolecular interaction. And that makes sense because otherwise these two would have looked the same as up here. If the linker was not able to modulate, if everything was dominantly trans and not cis. So we also wanted to take away any downstream effects because if the GQ, of course it's a tethered system, so we're approaching all of this with a huge grain of salt because we know we've tethered things and they can cause problems and that's a default assumption. So basically the idea is that if PKC was to activate cyclase, you would actually get more signaling. So you want to rule out the possibility that in the tethered context, something downstream is coming and feeding back. We've done lots of experiments, I'm only showing examples here. One is we can actually take the alpha-1 receptor, which activates GQ, use the same tethered system and show that when I tether alpha-1 to GQ, I get a lot more signaling. But beta-2, when I tether it to GQ, I don't get downstream signaling. So here I'm measuring inositol phosphate, which is downstream of the GQ activation. Of course, this again does not answer the question because what if there's just a smidge of GQ activation that we can't detect? That's enough because a lot of these signaling cascades rely on serial amplification. Small amount of PKC activation could still drive up the response. So what we wanted to do was we wanted to eliminate the activity part of the G protein. So here's the crystal structure of the beta 2 receptor with the, I'm only showing the G alpha S subunit. Of course, this is crystallized with the beta gamma that's not shown here. And an important part of this interface is this alpha helix that sticks into the receptor. So the alpha 5 helix, the terminal C terminus of the G protein, inserts into the receptor and the receptor clamps on top of it. That's part of the activation mechanism for the G protein. And it constitutes about 60 to 70% of the interface, energetic interface of that interaction. So now that allows us to remove this entire domain downstream and only put in the helix because that should mimic the interaction without having any downstream consequences. I'll just run you through some quick data. If you put this peptide, which we call it as the S peptide because it comes in the C terminus of the G alpha S, you see a slight increase in signaling. The Q peptide does better, scrambled not as much. You can do the same one for the D1 receptor. One more example of this is then we can actually make the GS look like the GQ. Just putting the peptide is now enough to make a chimeric protein is enough to mimic this response. So the idea is that somehow the interaction with the Q is making the receptor activate more of the S, which again is unheard of when you think about how you think about GPCR signaling. So we were not satisfied with our tethered system. We said this could all be completely artifactual, so we wanted to do it, reconstitute the system. So if I can reconstitute it with minimal ingredients and no linker, then I'm willing to believe it. And here's an example of how we do that. We express receptors in membranes. This is a classic way of doing it in GPCR biology, where you treat the membranes with urea, so you strip all the peripheral membrane proteins off. The receptor will still retain its activity. It'll be protected from the urea by the fact that all of the receptors embedded in the membrane, but all the peripheral proteins will be stripped out. Now I can add in pure G alpha S or G alpha Q, this recombinant protein. I washed out of all the urea, and I add in a BODP tagged GTP gamma S. So this is an activation assay. It's a direct measure of the activation of the G protein. So if I mix these two together, and now I'm using a ligand phenetrol, which will only target the beta 2 receptor. It's a specific agonist of the beta 2 receptor. And the amount of activation is measured by a change in the BODP fluorescence when this goes into the G protein. So now if I take membranes alone, I add in just the G alpha Q subunit, not much of an increase to be expected because I'm not activating the subunit. If I take membranes and add in G alpha S, of course it's going to activate its cognate, but the surprising result is all the way down here. As by example, I take this G alpha S and I add in just that peptide from the GQ, all of a sudden the signal shoots up. There's no crosstalk between the peptide and the G alpha S because if I remove the membranes, these two don't talk to each other. So it's very specific that the peptide is somehow, peptide meaning the part of the interface that hits the receptor, somehow hits the receptor and signaling emerges downstream. So we published this paper earlier where we basically proposed three different models. So the canonical model is one receptor, one G protein at a time. G protein gets activated and then you produce downstream. We call this as priming because it's increasing the amount of signaling, and we posited that there's one of three possible models by which it can actually occur. The first is where one of the G proteins interacts with the receptor and it comes off. And it's the orthosteric site, meaning it's the same place that all the G proteins like to interact. Now the receptor remembers that interaction and now fires off this G protein. The second would be where you would have both of them somehow interacting simultaneously, and you have an allosteric site that influences the receptor. And the third, which is that maybe the two receptors interact. There's no heavy, these receptors don't dimerize. These are class A GPCRs. If they interact transiently on the membrane, but perhaps that interaction is sufficient for this information flow to go backwards through the receptor. I wanted to elaborate a little bit more so you get a sense as to where the signaling field is, to put this in the context of what's coming out in the GPCR field. So the first idea would be what I call memory, where the receptor remembers its previous interaction. And there's actually a paper that came out from the Ferenc group where they demonstrated this quite nicely last year for rhodopsin. Rhodopsin, of course, as you know, is the dark sheep of the GPCR family. It always leads things, but also gets blamed because it works very differently than the other class A GPCRs. And so here's an example where rhodopsin gets activated by light, forms meta-rhodopsin. The receptor adopts an active conformation. And even after the ligand, which is all transretinol, comes off, the receptor takes a long time spectroscopically to return to the ground state. This is on the order of minutes. This is not seconds. So it's a metastable state where the protein stays active for a long time after the ligand or anything else has disappeared. Yes? Yes. 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 So we're jumping a little bit ahead. I'll come back to your question. Long story short, we tried knocking down GQ. We weren't very effective in being able to knock down GQ. So the question has not been answered because we're moving to primary cell lines where GQ is highly prevalent. And where this becomes relevant for the beta 2 receptor is in my throat right now, because there is plenty of GQ in smooth muscle cells, which also respond to endothelin. And so we're trying to use lentiviral knockdowns of GQ to see a paradoxical decrease in the GS. So yes, that's definitely one line of thinking, but I'll take you down a slightly different line of thinking and come back to you again. So this is one way to start thinking about memory. And of course, what you have to appreciate is this is, when this came out, there was a lot of pushback because if you think of the GPCR, it's a dynamic structure. And for a protein of that nature to hold a conformation for that long in the absence of ligand belies allostery. It's pushing the edge of what one would like, as some people say, water does not have memory. So you're kind of moving away from what people are willing to believe. But this is where the field is at. And of course, if GPCRs can do it, just keep in mind that this may not be unique to GPCRs. It's probably possible for a lot of molecules in the cell when we start thinking about it. The second one is, again, the allosteric site interaction. Again, to put it into perspective of where the GPCR field is, there was a paper from Bob Lefkowitz's group that suggested that beta arrestin, which is traditionally something that shuts down the receptor signaling, is proposed in this paper with evidence in cryo-EM, that it can simultaneously bind to the receptor. So they're able to see in cryo-EM the beta arrestin hanging on for dear life from the edge of the receptor while the G protein is still bound. and they pause it and show data that when this beta restin is actually interacting with the receptor, it actually facilitates the activation of the cognate G protein. So while it is beta restin here, the same model in principle we think could also be applying for G proteins. But think of the jump, because now two things are interacting simultaneously, although at slightly different sites. The third is asymmetric oligomers, which has come out from Jonathan Javitch's group, and others have also proposed this. So this is a little bit more of an established idea in the field. And it is something like this. You have a receptor. Think of it as a lock and key. This rectangle is inactive receptor. A receptor, when it gets activated, turns into this trapezium, which is one type of shape. If the two trapeziums are right next to each other, they don't do as well in terms of how much activity you get. It gets activated, but not so much. But if this trapezium is somehow stabilized by a reverse conformation, sort of an inverted trapezium, in other words, if an active receptor sits next to an inactive receptor, there's some sort of induced fit that keeps the active receptor active, and so together they produce a lot more signal through an intermolecular interaction. So the main idea that's emerging in the context of signaling, this is the big picture idea, is interactions are multiplexed. In other words, thinking about signaling as A goes to B goes to C goes to D is going to be, in my opinion, a thing of the past. And we have to sort of begin to embrace the fact that kinetics and structural dynamics are going to dominate our way of thinking of how signaling goes forward. So I'll give you, this is published, and I don't want to get too far into data, but I'll tell you where we are right now in terms of a model. And we actually do favor the memory model. And we have now data, this is our most recent model, with a lot of experimental data that I'm going to ignore, that actually shows quite conclusively that what happens is that the receptor, in fact, interacts with one G protein. We have data that it interacts with the exact same site that has been done by mutagenesis. The G protein, in fact, comes off. And I'll show you one key piece of data that shows that the receptor does populate a state where it holds memory, that it's able to actually keep that information even though the G protein is gone. And now it holds a state that's better than when if it had never interacted with the G protein in the first place. That's why this is drawn in red here as opposed to black. So memory actually improves signaling. And in fact, this is drawn blue. This is now a non-cognate pathway. The blue actually interacting with a different partner, in fact, does even better. That's why the GQ activates the signaling even better. I know some of you are flummoxed. There's a lot of data that I'm going to ignore, but I'm going to point to one key piece, which is in this for this to all of this to happen, which is that the receptor has to hold that memory for a little bit of time. And how do we actually address this? So Tejas came up with a very clever assay, which is we can actually take this peptide and we can introduce a photocleavable tyrosine, which is at the end here. And we know from structural work from our group as well as others that if you were to remove these last three amino acids, then the interaction becomes really weak, and in essence, the interaction disappears. So now this gives us a way to essentially do an experiment where at any point we can just cut this peptide out. So here's how the experiment is done. You mix the peptide along with the G protein and the receptor, and you mix the ligand and this BODP, the same assay I talked about earlier. You have them in separate tubes, you mix them together, you take a spec, and 3 minutes later, you take another spec. And the idea is that once all of this goes together, the reaction starts cooking, and the amount of fluorescence increase that you see is an indication of how well the receptor is able to activate this G protein. So now I'll lead you through just one experiment. So here, for example, I'm looking at how this peptide, so the presence of the Q peptide increases the fluorescence. That's what I've been telling you so far. That's the priming aspect. This is just showing as a control experiment that the photocleavable peptide also has the same effect. So by introducing the tyrosine, things are not as bad. And then here's an example where if I pre-cleave the peptide, so I expose this to UV, and I get rid of the peptide, the photocleavable peptide is not able to go. But if I mix everything together, wait a minute so that things are moving along, and then I zap it with UV, so I'm actually removing the peptide, the receptor just continues to hum along and produce signal as though it never lost its partner. So this is an example of an experiment. We have other experiments like this that are beginning to show that the receptor does have some conformational memory, which has consequences in the context of signaling. So let's ask a very simple question in terms of structure. Yeah?
So maybe I'm lifetime of this memory?
Yes.
And what is the protein chemistry?
Yes. So lifetime, you're not jumping the gun. The lifetime is on the order, at least right now, of 3 minutes. So the half time for it to decay to the ground state is in the order of about 2 to 3 minutes, as far as we can resolve it. So it's a really long-lived state. We're not the only ones to propose this. There's other data from Brian Kobylka's lab, unpublished, that also suggests this. In terms of the chemistry behind it, I'll just go to the slide. So go ahead. Go ahead.
Right. Because I'm just wondering, I'm assuming now there are microwaves and there are some in the facility, of course. But is it simply a memory? Is it also biasing by supplying the gates?
So could you be more specific about gating? Because that's a loaded term. Go ahead.
Yeah, so in the sense that, suppose if you have GS and GQ in a neighborhood, then you would produce a signal. If you have only GS, then you would produce a signal. It's also spatially.
Yeah.
Is it only necessarily
only a memory based? No, I obviously am not excluding other forms, but this is the simplest form, and this is probably new in terms of our thinking of GPCR. So others are possible, but what I will say is that this data is different than a gating system. Okay, so what do we think structurally is happening? So the way the receptor works, we had some data on this, is that when it binds to the cognate G protein, the C-terminus actually inserts quite deep into the receptor, and that's important because the binding energy from that interaction or that yanking of the C-terminus is what activates the GTPase activity. It opens the G protein and then allows the GDP to come out, so the GEF activity is stimulated by tight binding. So obviously, because it does not activate a non-cognate G protein, the non-cognate G protein has to bind shallow. That's how it's going to be. It's not going to bind, it's not going to fit. But in due process, it still has an imprint on the conformation of the receptor. And this is interpreted now through a model from Brian Kobylka's group, where the suggestion is that if you look at the energy landscape of the receptor, there's an inactive state and an active state. In the absence of the ligand, the inactive state is obviously the favorable conformation and the active state. But the key advance is that the receptor has a lot of intermediate states. It's not a single activation barrier. But once it goes in the inactive state, it could bounce around in a lot of intermediate states, and this is spectroscopically supported by a lot of NMR data. So this is not just a made-up model. The idea is that what agonist does is not really influence the energy of the active state, but it allows for a lot of search and capture mechanisms to come into play. The agonist makes the receptor more receptive, if you will, to the G protein. And then it's when you bind, in this case, a nanobody, which is actually mimicking this G protein, that you finally lock and key mechanism is engaged and you yank open. So what we're proposing is that when you have these other elements in the cell that are all playing in that thermal bath, they actually are influencing these intermediate conformations. And those intermediate conformations may be long-lived enough that when the receptor then interacts with another G protein, they have an influence. And so in the meeting of GPCR meeting that I was just at, this concept is coming up in other forms, and it's the idea that a lot of these molecules, like receptors, have microstates, and there's a continuum of microstates that you can actually see structurally. But we're actually beginning to demonstrate that these microstates are actually able to influence the signaling that's coming downstream. So we're talking about very detailed concepts here. What's the bottom line? How does this actually impact GPCR signaling? So where this comes really front and center in drug discovery is a concept of functional selectivity. It comes to, Neha, your question earlier, which is that, of course, different cells have different G proteins, different environments, and so you throw your hands up in the air and say anything done in a hex cell is bad, just do it in a primary cell, right? So the idea is that functional selectivity is a sort of idea or a concept where if you have the same receptor and it bound to one type of ligand, it will activate one G protein. But the same receptor, when bound to a different ligand, will activate a different G protein. So this ligand is functionally selective for GS. This ligand is functionally selective for GI. This is hugely important in drug discovery because if you can identify functionally selective ligands, it has a big impact in terms of steering your GPCR to signal through a pathway of your choice and away from a pathway that's detrimental in a particular disease state. So how does this play a role? How does this idea of memory or priming play a role? Well, information is flowing both ways. this G protein will impact that pathway, this G protein will impact that pathway. So there's a lot of information flow that happens both ways. I'll illustrate a very practical example of how this works. So you're all familiar with beta blockers. Beta blockers are used in hypertension and also in the context of early stages of heart failure. And so the way a beta blocker works, it will bind to the receptor and block the signaling through the receptor. It can do so one of two ways. It can either pull the foot of the receptor out, away from the accelerator, that is removing the stimulation, or it can actually jam on the brake as well. So if it jams on the brake actually will also hit cyclists. And as you can imagine, if you're driving through traffic, you're likely to pull your foot off the accelerator and jam the brake so you avoid the cyclist at the same time. So doing both is quite effective in terms of being a more stronger beta blocker. So we had shown some years ago, I'll skip over the technique, that metoprolol, which is a very commonly prescribed anti-hypertensive and beta blocker, not only blocks GS, it also activates GI. So that is shown here, just ignore the readout for a second, that it inactivates GS but activates GI. So what I've been telling you so far is if you have isoproterenol and that essentially leads to GS signaling, GI is the non-cognate, GI can stimulate signaling through GS. But what is also true is metoprolol, which is now a biased agonist, which activates GI, actually is synergistic with GS. So here, if you have metoprolol and you have this peptide from DS, the GS pathway actually paradoxically drives signaling through the GI pathway. And this becomes really important because we're very stuck in signaling that cognate is cognate and non-cognate is non-cognate, preferred pathway, non-preferred pathway. Here we're seeing that preferred pathways can influence non-preferred pathways and vice versa. Information flows both ways in cell signaling. And where this becomes really relevant is we can leverage these sorts of technologies to understand and look for specific biased ligands. Because now we have ways to stabilize conformational states of the receptor that allow us to find ligands that are very specific to a particular pathway. And so I'm going to end, sorry, go ahead.
Maybe you answered, but I'm not clear. So if you deplete one versus the other,
yeah.
Do you compromise signaling through what is present as well, or GI versus GS?
Yeah, so I think if you deplete one, you will compromise signaling through the other in both ways, yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yes.
GI. Does Ericsson also require such cognate partner, or it's completely?
We have some preliminary data, which is exciting for the field, that in fact the GS can actually stimulate arrestin signaling and arrestin can stimulate GS signaling, vice versa. So this is not restricted to, because it's a property of the receptor in terms of microstates, this also applies to arrestin, but that's an area we're not as deeply into.
I assume arrestin doesn't bind the same way as GS or GI.
Yes, but the conformational state argument still applies because arrestin also has to sense a different conformation. So in summary here, I'm going to end here so that Roop doesn't have to tackle me, which is that the GPCR-G protein interactions are inherently multiplex. So hopefully you're learning something new from here about how to start thinking about cell signaling. It might have given you a headache, but it is a headache that I hope you will embrace. And the idea is, this is the big picture point, is that a lot of information is buried in weak interactions. Weak dynamic interactions go on to shape a lot of cell signaling. And I will skip, for in the interest of time, a few additional slides I have on kinases because it will reflect the same point. Safe to say that the same message we're getting in the GPCR world has equal applications for how kinases select substrates. And if you're really keen on it, you can talk to me after. But the main message I want to leave you with is that what's emerging in cell signaling is to stop thinking of things as, you know, I'll give you a very classic example. If you want to find out what signals from where, a lot of people will use co-immunoprecipitations to identify binding partners. Well, you are inherently going after strong interactions and not weak interactions. And what we're finding is that it's the weak interactions that really have a dominant effect. And so the context in which those interactions happen, we need new technologies, including the ones that we're trying to develop, in order to understand this in a more sophisticated way. Okay, with that, I'll stop, and I think we've had questions. If there's more questions, I'd be happy to take them as well. So I just put up the acknowledgement slide and skip this. Yeah.
Yeah. If you say these are weak interactions, can you comment like the specificity of the signal that is produced? Because one of the gates, it can be brake or accelerator. So the specificity, because the mechanical stiffness of the molecules will decide whether it is going to be break or fast.
Yeah.
So stochastically,
yes.
Do you think you can have error rates and specificity of such a single link?
Yeah, I mean, so I have to qualify that it's weak, it's not non-existent, right? Because, I mean, so to be more specific, I think you need interactions on the order of tens of micromolar to have an influence on the conformation of the receptor. Otherwise, the amount of thermal energy that's present in the system will override anything that, a millimolar affinity interaction can imprint on the receptor. In other words, if I had something that just bound to the receptor and just pinged off the receptor, it should not have any effect on the receptor because it doesn't have enough energy in it. And so by weak, I'm talking about tens of micromolar. Strong, I'd probably say hundreds of nanomolar to nanomolar. Yes, go ahead.
In this regime of weak interactions,
yes.
You essentially tune the system using linker guns.
Yes.
So that the effective concentrations are variable.
Correct.
But in reality, many of the multi-protein systems operate very effectively using post-translational modifications.
Yes.
That's a very, very efficient way of modulating weak interactions directionally.
Correct.
Your system doesn't have any of that.
We don't need that is what we're arguing. So I'm not arguing against it, yes.
In this context, you don't need that.
Yes.
But in the context of multiple weak interactions that happen inside the cell,
correct.
Inside the cell,
yes.
ATMs are extremely crucial.
Correct. Yes, so I think that's a good argument in the sense that if you look at signaling cascades like RAS, RAF, MEK, ERK that are further downstream, the way you get fidelity is by having a covalent modification that is going to stay on there, and that allows for sort of ratchet-like mechanism in which the system works. So this far upstream, it seems to be that nature has evolved multiple sort of chaotic pathways that can happen without the need for this sort of covalent interaction imprinting. And the reason I posit that this is how it's evolved, so just thinking more philosophically, is because no GPCR has ever evolved without all its partners present. So if you think of evolution, there are multiple G proteins. There's 20 different types of G proteins, right? So all of this evolution of structure has happened in a multi-protein system. So our understanding is limited as reductionist beings to think of things as 1, 2, 3, 4. But nature has evolved very nicely to embrace this sort of weak interaction paradox. Yes.
Final mystery, the specificity that happened at the very end.
Yes.
This is just the beginning of the story.
Right, but I think this is sort of like, you know, for lack of a better word, if you don't get it right here, then everything downstream is gone, right? Because this is right at Gangotri. This is like if you pollute the waters up there, then
isn't that here a lot of noise is tolerated?
No, actually not. That's what our data seems to suggest, that it's actually, if anything, the noise is going to get amplified. In other words, the amount of signal, once you choose to send small amount of signal versus here, the amplifiers downstream, like adenylate cyclase, IP3, they actually amplify signals downstream. So once you go downstream and you're committed to a certain pathway, that pathway has fidelity. But how much you choose to go one or the other in GPCRs seems to be a property that is tuned very finely on the conformation of GPCR. I know from your expression that seems kind of weird. But I will say this, that if you think about phylogenetic diversity, like you need a finite number of GPCRs to give you a lot of inputs. And you think of wind signaling or something that you have so many different, very closely related ligands, this makes perfect sense. It's working as its own processor on the membrane that's sort of tuned for that particular pathway. We can have a more philosophical discussion later.
Yes. You need to come on the boat, right? For more discussion. Jake, do you have a question?
Yes.
No.
Yes. Yeah, so I think, Brian Kobylka presented this data about a couple of years ago, and he was shouted down by everybody saying 2 minutes is too long for GPCRs, even though he's a Nobel laureate, right? So what we, without giving it away, we don't know exactly, but there are some unstructured domains in the GPCR that we think that after these interactions imprint, undergo, intrinsically disordered to ordered transition. So in other words, you actually have loops in the GPCR that actually we think will adopt, go from loop to helical. So it's not just fluctuations and changes in fluctuations, but there's like a ratchet where there's a change from disorder to order transition. And those can create like electrostatic interactions that will hold the molecule in. So that basically it's sort of, the stabilization can come from structural transitions. Yes. Sorry, yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
Okay, students get priority.
Absolutely, yeah, go ahead. Yes. Ah, good. Great. Great question. Why do you want memory, right? Not just from the perspective of this, but if you think about adrenaline as a hormone, and if you have a fight or flight response, your pituitary gland will secrete adrenaline for just a fraction of a second, right? And so we think that this is a way to actually have the GPCR signal for just a little longer. Because if your heart rate needs to go up and if the ligand gets washed away, we know that for almost all hormones, except for the ones that are peptide-based, the lifetime of these biogenic amines is actually very small on the receptor. They don't bind very well. They bind, trigger, and go away. So if the receptor remembers that, then it's a way of perpetuating the signal. So I think in that context, in that 1 to 2 to 3 minute regime, it's important. But beyond 3 minutes, there's going to be desensitization. That's where beta arrestin comes in. So we're talking about the early window of the life of the GPCR, not the later window. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead. You're talking about what if there's two different GPCR and two different ligands at the same time? Well, that's a higher order complexity problem, right? In other words, now these two receptors will now have to share information with each other. So that is hopefully some physicists here will take on the challenge of modeling it before I have to do a more complex experiment.
But the two ligands in one system, so how the memory can change?
Two ligands, one GPCR. Well, they will have to be an allosteric ligand. And so, yes, they can't both bind on the same site. But you know, again, open-ended question. That's why I said it was a first-order attempt to bring some complexity. And now, hopefully, physicists will bring sanity by modeling it. Yes?
Is this memory a feature only of membrane-embedded receptors, or do you also see it in
ACRIs? I don't know. My instinct is that it is there in a lot of systems. Like, for example, we have data on kinases. When you mix two different substrates, one can influence another. Right?
In solution.
We're talking about just the catalytic domain of the kinase. So my big picture thought would be that if you have elements that are intrinsically disordered, that can be triggered to have order, that's how you create memory, by without having to invoke water-based allosteric, because that's on the time scale of microseconds. But if you can have order to disorder transitions that are energetically just triggered because the nucleation is limiting, that's where memory can be stored.
Okay,
but that's hypothetical. Yeah.
Level of amplifiers like adenine, like cyclase, or
PC, yes,
you do not have diversity. I mean, you do not kind of activate. You do not have multiplicity there.
Yes.
Why do you assume that?
I can't assume that because I'm saying that I was more speaking to the point that once post-translational modifications come, you have much more fidelity in the system because post-translational modifications. I mean, the whole idea from Brian Koshland et al. Is that PTMs are a great way because you imprint information that's there and it changes the protein state completely. You could still have multiplicity, but conformational memory will not dominate is the point that he's making, and it's absolutely true, right?
P53 is the best studied example. P53 time evolves in terms of PTM states. At a different states, P53 is a different avatar.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. And so they have these called signaling barcodes, right? So. But what I will leave you with is that is more maturely understood. This is now what's coming. That's where we're going. Yeah. The Dashavatar, fair enough.
Okay. So
yeah.
If you look at the response properties of ganglion cells or olfactory receptor neurons, as soon as you turn off the stimulus, immediately the firing disappears, right?
Yes. Right. Yeah, so I'm not positing that every single receptor is going to do it. Can you tell me what GPCR you're talking about or thinking about? Is it serotonin or are you thinking about class C?
The olfactory receptors, right?
Okay, olfactory receptors. Yeah. I don't know. I'm not operating at a physiological level. At least in the context of biogenic amines, I think that there is a reason for persistence response because we can actually detect persistent response. So in the absence of it, I don't know what it's possibly doing, if it continues to signal.
But for dopaminergic neurons, right?
Yes.
Essentially, it's again the same problem, right? Because there also the timing is extremely important.
Yes.
But if your signal goes on for 3 minutes, essentially, that means now the most important stimulus block response
that. Right, that is actually a very interesting point, and I think, you know, in my delusional world, I'd like to think of that's where memory imprinting can possibly happen, because there are going to be changes in the state of the cell that don't lead to like something you can measure in electrophysiology, but the state is still thinking about what's going on, right? So that's of course pure rabid speculation.
Okay, well, last question.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So the one experiment that excludes PTMs is the urea strip experiment. I mean, I think that experiment is where I have killed every possible, kinase or phosphatase in the membrane by treating it with 8 molar urea. So it's a completely purified system that at least says that if it's happening, it's not happening through a PTM. I have no nucleotide. I have no way to actually imprint a PTM.
Absolutely. In your assay system, it seems to be clean, but in your
Yes, yes.
So,
right, absolutely. So PTMs are, yeah, so PTMs, I am absolutely agreeing with you that PTMs are a way to store memory. So PTMs, this is not the only way to store memory. The traditional way of storing memory is to change the PTM pattern through post-translation modifications and feedback loops. Oh, okay, yeah, yes. Okay. I will leave you with one thought and we have to go, which is that we think that there's synergies between what I'm showing you and GRK5. So that, yes, of course, because if you change the microstates of the receptor, other elements that are imprinting PTMs will also come in. So the main thought to leave you with is, as engineers, the difficulty is we have to work with simplified systems to get new concepts in, and then we leave it to the biologist to muddy the waters again by throwing in a few more molecules. Sorry.
Okay, well, thank you. Audience, and
thank you
very much. We come back here in 15 minutes. 15 minutes.
Thank you.
I will argue with you that the initial response will be noisy and
okay.
Rare filtration.
Probably it is different here.
Yes.
In other
systems,
rare filtration happens much later.